America, Iran, and Eru, considering that you need to ask all the OEM in the area. And I guess one way to solve that was to ask the government, and to, so because the police, I suppose they had permission to go into everybody's house. It's like it's their own issues to go into the house. So it's like it's the, if they own the police, so you. So once you, it was just the police department, then it's like it's as if you ask the whole people. But nowadays, I think that they changed. They need like a search warrant or something. It's like they can just want to stop for no reason. So how
what
is it for them to
get
an
Eruv? Yeah, it is a very interesting question. Let me just give a little background in case not everyone knows the background of the question.
Can you restate the question?
I'll restate the question. It's actually a very complicated question. I'm not sure if it's this is even the best forum to address it. But you know, we know that on Shabbos you're not allowed to carry in what is called a public domain. A public domain is not a question of public ownership versus private ownership. It is a question of enclosed versus unenclosed. You can carry under Torah law if an area is enclosed by walls, like in a house. You cannot carry under Torah law if it's an area that is open and the like. Now, halachically, the definition of a wall can include a wires like an Erev, so it doesn't have to be a solid wall. The wire itself has a din of a wall. However, there's another aspect that the sages prohibited. And they said that even if an area is enclosed, either by a real wall or by the so-called artificial wall of the wires that is called a tsuras ha-pesach, the shape of a doorway, there is still a problem that you're not allowed to carry from an area that is only used by one family to an area that is used by many families. And thus, you wouldn't be able to carry even something like this. You couldn't carry, perhaps, from a single apartment into a hallway, even though everything is enclosed, because the hallway is used by everybody. So, in order to get around that problem, the sages enacted a rule that is called Erev. See, the whole word Erev is a misnomer. When you ask a person what is an Erev, everybody says it's that wire. That's not true. That is just the wall. That is the Tzuras HaPesach. But the word Erev, which means combination, is a basic halachic mechanism that joins multiple users into a single unit. And the way that's done is by the joint ownership of some food, like a box of matzah or bread, and that joins us all together. So it's that box of matzah that is really the Erev. Without that box of matzah, you wouldn't be allowed to carry from even your single apartment into a hallway. We have to join everybody and make them one unit by the ownership of food. It is indeed a quite complicated subject. Now, all of this is background to this question. This question is even going further than that, and that is, as a general rule, you can only do this joinder between Jews. If there are non-Jews in your area, you cannot really join them into making an Erev. So the way Chazal allowed it is that the Jewish people have to rent the area, so to speak, from the non-Jewish people, and as a result, it becomes like a Jewish property in which everybody can be reunited. Now, theoretically, that would mean every single non-Jew who lives within an area would have to be given some rental money, could be a shekel or whatever it is. So the way it works in modern society is that when you want to build an Erev in Chicago or New York or Baltimore or Lakewood, you approach the municipal government, which acts on behalf of its residents, and you lease the space from the municipal government. That's an essential part of the construction of a modern Erev. All right, so all of this is background. Again, we're not even up to your question yet, so that's a very complicated question. So here is the issue. The theory, the halachic theory, why the municipal government can act on behalf of the individual residents is because they really own the property, because they can kick you out, they can condemn your property, they can enter whenever they want, therefore they have the status of an owner, and therefore the lease can be done with them and doesn't have to be done with the individual non-Jew. The argument goes that in modern governmental entities, the government does not have that same power. The government cannot just enter your house and kick you out. Right? The Third Amendment, everyone talks about the First Amendment of the Constitution, freedom of speech. and the Second Amendment is gun control. That's very the right of guns. That's very controversial. And the Fourth Amendment is no search and seizure without a search warrant. But nobody ever knows about the Third Amendment, right? Who knows the Third Amendment? The Third Amendment actually prohibits the quartering of soldiers in a home without permission. That actually was a big problem in the British times. They would just show up and say, soldiers are taking over your house. That is against the Constitution. So the argument is, and Rebbe Yeshiv actually made this argument, you can't make an Eruv by renting from the government when you have non-Jews, because the government doesn't have the type of ownership that would allow them to be the owners. So how can you make an Eruv? Well, the truth is that Rebbe Yeshiv did say your svara, so you were mechaven, or perhaps you heard Rebbe Yeshiv say this. But the bottom line is that when push comes to shove, the government still does have a power called eminent domain. The government does have the power to take any property it wants, although it has to pay you. So eminent domain itself is still enough of a power that they are considered to be the owners of the property. In fact, there was a famous, I don't want to get into the law of eminent domain, but there was a very famous controversial Supreme Court opinion around 10 years ago, in which not only can the government take the property for the government's purpose, but if the government thinks a hotel will generate more tax revenue than you're sitting there in your house, they can take your house, give the property to a hotel chain, and as a result, they can claim that that's a governmental benefit, because they'll get more taxes from the hotel. That's an extremely controversial case, and people who are politically conservative attack that case a lot. But halachically, that underscores the point that the government is still a bialim because of that ultimate power. Okay, so that's a bit of a complicated problem. Bottom line is, you can make Erevin. Yeah?
Thank you.
Why does Judaism have to come from the mother?
That's an excellent question. Everyone knows that the cornerstone of Jewish identity is called matrilineal descent, which is a little strange because with respect to everything else, we follow the father. Whether you're a Kohen or not a Kohen is based on dad, not based on mom. Whether you're from whatever tribe you are is based on your father. But the most important issue of are you Jewish, are you not Jewish, that is based on the mother. So first of all, let me point out an interesting comment of the Ramban on Chumash, one of our greatest commentators. He actually points out that before the Torah was given, in the book of Genesis, for example, religious lineage would be based on the father. He says this was actually an innovation. So when the Reform Movement says, it's kind of a very disingenuous thing, the Reform Movement says, oh yeah, matrilineal descent is a later innovation. Well, in a perverse way, they are actually correct. It is a later innovation. It dates from the giving of the Torah. Okay. And of course, God is the one who made the innovation. But okay. But you know, in even the worst lies, there's a kernel of truth, and there actually is a kernel of truth that before the Torah was given, it was based on the father. Now, why is it based? Why would it be based on the mother? So. We don't know for sure, but I'll give you a few possibilities. One possibility is that you never know, particularly in a promiscuous society, you never know who the father is. Maternity is the only data that can be established without doubt, because a person might be with multiple men, including adultery and the like, and therefore we wanted to have a guarantee of Jewish lineage that can only be passed through the mother. That's a pragmatic reason. A spiritual reason is based on the Talmudic teaching that perhaps you heard, that before a person is born, the embryo, the fetus in the mother's womb, is taught the whole Torah by an angel. And when the child is born, the angel hits the kid on the mouth and the lip, and he forgets all of the Torah, but it's still imprinted in his soul. And consequently, apparently, even the baby before he's born is absorbing spiritual truth, and that spiritual truth comes via the mother. Now obviously people ask all sorts of questions. So how do you understand the nature of the soul of a convert? Let's say somebody was born from a non-Jewish mother. Whether the father is Jewish or not makes no difference here. What angel taught him the Torah? Did he have an angel teaching the Torah? Did he absorb the Torah? So there are different ways of understanding it. You know, there are some understandings that say that because God knows the future, it's as if everyone who does become Jewish actually started off life with a Jewish soul even before their conversion, and the angel kind of entered mysteriously the non-Jewish woman's body and taught the Torah. Others say that conversion effects a new soul. So in Shemayim, even a soul that's not in a body yet is absorbing the Torah, and when God puts that soul in the or that soul is held in abeyance, so when a person converts, he acquires a new soul. This is an old Kabbalistic machlokas. If we understand conversion as a new Jewish soul enters when you go to the mikveh, or get up from the mikveh, or rather, the person had a Jewish soul to begin with, and for mysterious reasons, that Jewish soul was placed in a non-Jewish body. So we don't have definitive, we have clear biblical sources, meaning it is a rule that it can be derived from the language of the Chumash. That much is so. But in terms of the actual logic, I would suggest both the pragmatic and the mystical. One final point about this, I don't want to spend a long time because I can give a whole shiur on this. And that is, because of modern fertility technologies, it is sometimes unclear who the mother is. Let's consider surrogate mothers or egg donors, one way or the other. Now, yes, Judaism is based on the mother. But let's imagine you have a woman that is infertile. She can carry a baby, but she doesn't ovulate properly. So one of the ways that such women are helped is they get a donated egg from somebody. That donated egg is fertilized by the husband's sperm, in vitro fertilization. And then it is transferred to the woman, and she gives birth 9 months later. Is that child Jewish or not Jewish? So you'll just say, well, if it has a Jewish mother, the child is Jewish. Yes, but who is the mother? Is it the woman that carried the fetus for 9 months? In which case it would be Jewish? Or is it the genetic mother who contributed 50% of the chromosomal material? Now, you can reverse it. It's the same question when you have surrogacy, in which the egg comes from the Jewish woman, but she, let's say she has a hysterectomy, she doesn't have a womb, and it's carried by a non-Jew. If I look at the genetic mother, the child is Jewish. If I look at the birth mother, not. So that's a question of who is the mother in those types of cases. But the one thing you do need to know is that there has to be a biological component one way or the other. So for example, adoption does not make a child automatically Jewish. If a Jewish couple adopts a child, even if it's from birth, and even if for all intents and purposes the Jewish mother has raised this child from birth, adoption alone does not make a non-Jewish child Jewish. That is why a baby has to undergo a conversion ceremony. It's a big mistake. Sometimes people say, oh, once you adopt, it's totally your child. For halachic purposes, that is not true. There is a conversion ritual for babies, including circumcision and mikvah. I don't mean you throw the baby into the mikvah, but usually the father will go to the baby and hold the baby in his arms and dunk him. And it's, don't be afraid if you ever have to do this. Until a baby is 6 months, it's actually very cute, they have a swimming reflex. When their face hits the water, and it has to be face first, they automatically hold their breath, and they start doing the dog paddle. It's very cute. They swim around a little bit. So if you want to do a conversion of an infant, the younger you do it, the better. Parents sometimes say, "Oh, maybe we should wait until the baby is 1 or 2 years old." No, actually, it's because the reflex atrophies with time. The first 6 months is the best time to do it. Yeah. Someone had a hand up. Yeah.
Referring to the teaching of the Torah in the womb.
Yeah.
I was in a philosophy class, and where there's a teaching of Aristotle, Plato. There's a theory of everything where it's very similar, where in the womb, like the whole meaning of life is taught, and the whole purpose of living, and it's forgotten when you're born.
Yes.
The whole purpose of living is to
regain
all that knowledge.
Yep.
Now my
guess, although I can't say I remember it, my guess is that sounds more like Plato than Aristotle, because Plato, as the Rambam says, was a bit of a mystic. The Rambam didn't like Plato, but the Rambam was such a rationalist, he liked Aristotle. And Plato, by the way, says another thing that's in rabbinic literature, that originally man and woman were one, and then they were separated, and marriage is when you get reunited with the wholeness that you once were, which again is exactly there. So the issue of, you know, who's first is it can always be a controversial issue. I will tell you, we actually have rabbinic references to Plato meeting the prophet Jeremiah around the destruction of the temple. Now, the first temple was destroyed in the year 586 BCE, which is around Plato's time. It actually corresponds. And Plato, it is said, met Jeremiah, and he saw Jeremiah weeping and crying over the destruction of the temple. And when Plato said, "Why are you mourning a building? A building is a building. What difference does it make?" So Jeremiah said to Plato, "Are there any philosophical problems that you don't have answers to?" And Plato said, "Yeah, these are my problems," and Jeremiah answered them. And he said, "That's why I mourn the temple. The temple was the channeling that brought God into our lives, giving us this insight." So apparently there was some connection between the Greek philosophers and not even the rabbis of the Mishnah. This is before the rabbis of the Mishnah. These are the prophets of the Bible. And therefore, it's entirely possible that there was an influence from the Jewish people to Plato and the like. In the Talmud later, we have debates, very interesting metaphysical debates between the Tanoim, the rabbis of the Mishnah, and the Chachmei Atuna. Chachmei Atuna means the wise men of Athens. So apparently there was such an interaction. Yeah.
What is Judaism's stance on dinosaurs? Did they exist? Did they not? Do we have references about them? And if we don't, then how do we deal with the current science?
Yeah. So really, the issue of dinosaurs is really linked to the age of the Earth, meaning to say, there's nothing wrong in principle if you say there were dinosaurs 5,000 years ago. I say, sure, you know, that wouldn't be theologically problematic. There may be all sorts of big, gigantic animals. And in fact, in the beginning of Genesis, beginning of Bereishis, it talks about God creating the giant serpents, taninim. Very obscure. It's not clear what that is. In the book of Iyov, book of Job, there is a reference to the behemoth, the word behemos, which is in English we say behemoth, huge animals. So the principle of huge, scary animals that, you know, Hashem really put away because they would be so destructive to the human race certainly finds several references throughout the Tanakh and in the Gemara itself. In fact, there's even a book called Mysterious Creatures by Rabbi Slifkin, who tries to gather all the rabbinic sources about different unusual monstrous animals. So it's not the monstrous nature of the dinosaur that really raises the problem. The real problem, of course, is the age of the dinosaurs, that based on scientific dating, based on carbon dating, based on fossil records, so we scientists posit that the dinosaurs existed, you know, millions and millions of years ago. And that, of course, does raise a fundamental problem, because under our Jewish chronology, we are in the year 5,776, less than 5,800 years ago. And how does that correspond with millions and even billions of years? If you go before the dinosaurs, they have a few billion years before there were dinosaurs as well. And that does raise, you know, many, many difficult issues. And again, this deserves a talk of its own. I think maybe we'll even have a talk of its own. But let me just mention one thing, a very simple thing. There are complicated answers based on Einstein's relativity theories that simultaneously something can be young and something can be old at the same time, depending on how you measure time. But I don't want to get into the... Sometimes physics sounds like Kabbalah, and, you know, so I don't want to get into the difficult scientific way of defining time. But there is a Midrashic passage that says this was not the first world. Before there was this world, there were other prior worlds that God created that he destroyed. Now, here's the thing. Most people seem to think that means there were some other worlds out there that God destroyed. But it doesn't have to mean that. It could actually mean this planet Earth existed in different forms, and then it was wiped out, and then God recreated. And as a result, therefore, fossils, dinosaurs, and the like can all be remnants of those pre-Adam worlds, which are before the beginning part of the Torah. The Torah starts from this world in which there are human beings, but the Medrash tells us there were prior worlds. So that might be one response. Now, if we start asking the question, why did God create those prior worlds if there was no Torah? I don't know. Those are great mysteries. But Chazal do say that such worlds did exist. So that would be the simplest answer. And again, I can give you some even numbers based on the Zohar that would be quite amazing, in which the Mekubalim did come up with years that are similar to the modern scientific understanding of the age of the Earth. Now, there is another approach that some people favored. Actually, it was first advanced by Christian theologians in the 19th century after Darwin, and some rabbis have adopted it, although they don't necessarily credit. Maybe, well, I don't want to say they adopted it. They thought of it on their own, but it turned out to be a similar idea. And I don't like, I don't like it, but I'll tell you what they say. They say that God, number one, made the world old, meaning to say that since God created the world in a fully mature state, so if you have a redwood tree that is 1,000 years old, at the very beginning of creation, there would be this 1,000-year-old tree. So as a result, there was petroleum in the ground, even though that scientifically would take tens of thousands of years. Right? So if the world was created old, all of these old things would be there. There is also a theory, which I like even worse, or I dislike even more, that said God put things in this world to trick us into thinking that the world is older than 5775, because that way we have to exercise our free will to believe in God's creation. Otherwise, it would be too obvious. But the concept that God deliberately tricks does not really sound that good. But there is such a theory. But as I say, I think the easiest one is prior worlds. Did someone have... Yeah?
I heard once a concept that Islam's prayer rituals and stuff are reminiscent of Yom Kippur, how they bow to the floor, and we bow to the floor, how they have five
prayers. Yep, exactly right.
Is there some link that you know of and why that could be and why... We wouldn't do that normally, and they would.
Well, once again, you know, Islam, although not all Muslims are Arabs, obviously, but the foundation of Islam is Arab culture, Muhammad, and Muhammad is, I'm sorry, Arab are Yishmael, really, they come from Abraham, and the very word Yishmael, God will listen, Yishmael, God will listen, and it is said that among the legacies that Yishmael got from Avraham, right? Yishmael mainly went off the derech and didn't become such a great guy. But one of the gifts that they got from Avraham, they got two gifts from Avraham. They got the gift of gracious hospitality. And this is actually a very interesting phenomenon, that the Arab will treat you very, very nicely when you're a guest in his home, and will only stab you in the back only when you are in the process of leaving. When you're in the home, you will be treated very, very, very nicely. And that is a kind of a perverted, positive aspect gotten from Avraham. And the other is the power of prayer, Yishmael. And as a result, this is why Muslims or the Arabs are very dangerous, because they have certain spiritual merits of prayer, of modesty, of hachnasas orchim, of hospitality. And that is why they cannot be defeated by political or military means. They can only be defeated by spiritual means, because they come with a spiritual power. That makes them much more dangerous. Now, the five connected to Yom Kippur, you know, I have heard that connection. I don't think Chazal specifically bring it up, but I think it's quite logical that if Yishmael's power is the power of prayer, then they will take the most powerful sequence of prayer that we have and use it against us, which is, you know, the Yom Kippur type prayers of five tefillos. Now, we don't do that every day because there is a concept that, from our perspective, if you do something every single day, you take away some of its power. Maybe that's the secret they don't know, that it's not, that Badavka doing this over and over and over and over again doesn't work as well as it would one time a year. But there is indeed such a connection. Yeah.
On Shabbat, we know it's a very holy day, and it's about connecting to God. We have more tefillos, we read the Torah, we study Torah a lot. We also increase our physicality a lot on Shabbat.
Yep.
So I'm wondering about that relation. It seems like a contradiction. And then if it's not, if it induces more spirituality, why don't we just do that all week long?
Okay, so I see, Baruch Hashem, you've been learning in a Litvashi yeshiva, you've now become a Litvak. See, a chassid wouldn't ask that question at all. And the reason is because you're positing, again, it's a very excellent question, you're positing, Shabbos is about spirituality, it's about holiness. So how come, you know, I eat more and I indulge, is that not a contradiction to holiness? Right? Spoken as a true Litvak, indeed. But here's the whole point. You're 100% correct. The whole point about Judaism is that instead of viewing physicality and even pleasure as something evil or bad, we view it as neutral. And that is, when you use it for gratification, you use it for hedonism, it's a bad thing that takes you away from God, for sure. But Judaism teaches us, the Torah teaches us, you can take even the physical, animalistic part of human existence, whether it's sexual reproduction, whether it's eating, whatever it would be, whether it's making money, it's not an animal function, but, you know, a material function. And you can be like an animal or be like a hedonist, or you can do it to serve Hashem properly. And then even the physical becomes holy, it becomes elevated, it becomes transformed. If you look in a sefer like the Tanya, don't get me in trouble here, but I see that people have Tanya on the shelves.
Everyone's on it nowadays.
Yeah, I know, that's a funny thing. Yeah, it's kind of strange. Okay, I used to have to keep it in a paper bag or something. But okay, now Baruch Hashem. But if you look at a sefer like the Tanya, you see very, very clearly that he actually quotes Mamari Chazal, but often people give him the quote. And that is, it's God's desire very specifically to dwell in this lowly world, not the realm of the angels, not in the ethereal, but to take the most physical, animalistic part of existence and bring out the holiness that is within it, so Hashem permeates everything. And that is why, b'derech klal, in Judaism, there is such an emphasis on physicality. I mean, every mitzvah is physical. I mean, you might think, you know, why do we have mitzvahs? Why do I put on tefillin? Let me sit, let me learn, let me think. Why do I take, you know, the leather? And all of that is, you take the physical materials of existence and you elevate them and you consecrate them. That is why, that unlike the Catholics who say that a holy person doesn't get married, right? If you're really holy, you're a priest, you don't get married. And we know the problems that causes. Judaism says no. The relationship of men and women can be animalistic, it can be decadent, it can be coarse, but it can also be something that is beautiful and elevated and holy, and it's our job to make those decisions. I'm sorry, did you have a question? Yeah,
I guess, like, I don't know which question I asked, so I'll just ask the one.
Okay.
So on Shabbat, I try to explain this to people, and it's hard for me to. So we get a second soul on Shabbos that eventually, you know, leaves. Can
yep.
you just explain that?
Yeah. Well, I would say the following. First of all, I would offer maybe an interesting alternative translation. The actual phrase is Neshama Yisera, which indeed is usually translated an extra soul, but I would suggest it means an enhanced, enlarged soul. It's not that, you know, you're schizophrenia, you have two souls in you, but your soul becomes bigger. Now, what do I mean by a soul becoming bigger? A soul is the way we feel God and commune with God and absorb godliness within ourselves. So an enlarged soul basically means that on Shabbos you have a greater ability to connect to God and feel God in your life. God is always in your life, but during the week we have less ability to feel it and to sense it. Shabbos, we have an enlarged receptor capacity. That would be there. Now, that doesn't mean, by the way, that's a capacity, that's a potential. That doesn't mean it happens automatically. You know, there's a saying in Chazal that he who prepares on Erev Shabbos, on Friday, will eat on Shabbos. Now, literally, that's quite true. If you don't get food or make food on Friday, you won't have what to eat. Although, I'm sure an Or Sameach will feed you one way or the other. But it also refers to a spiritual truth. If you want to have the soul food of Shabbos, you got to invest in your pre-Shabbos efforts by thinking, by learning, by getting yourself in the proper mood. So these things are not automatic. These are potentialities that God gives you, but whether or not they'll be actualized depends on the work that we do. But that's the concept of the extra soul, the capacity of godliness that you have in Shabbos. Yeah.
Why do you think it is that when some people speak of Jesus, they say Yimach Shemo is a crow, and you can maybe like speak
the... Well, Jesus, by the way, Jesus is a very, very harmless name. Jesus is simply the Greek for Joshua. So his name was Yehoshua, or Yeshua, they sometimes leave out the hey, but that's also in the Tanakh. And that's why the Jews for Jesus to try to convert Jews will always call him Yeshua, which is, you know, that's, you know, sorry.
Yeshua,
yeah, which also means salvation. Yeah, it's connected. But, so Jesus is, you know, Jesus is just a name, just the Greek for Joshua. But as you know, he of course was born a Jew. He of course died as a Jew, no question about it. But in our tradition, he is regarded as a bit of a renegade, a Jew. Now, what Jesus himself claimed versus what later people put into his mouth is a difficult, complicated, controversial question, which I'm not going to fully get into. But nevertheless, the religion which was eventually founded in his name, although he did not found it himself, is considered to be antithetical to Judaism in many, many ways. So the phrase Yimach Shemo V'Zichro, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, I know obviously some of you have, this is something you attach after a person who is a real, real bad fellow. Yimach Shemo V'Zichro means may his name and his memory be blotted out forever. So for example, Hitler would be the example where, you know, almost everybody, when they mention Hitler, they might say Yimach Shemo V'Zichro, Amalek, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro. So, some people, when they say Jesus, by the way, saying Jesus is permitted, you shouldn't use the phrase or the term Christ, I mean, in connection with his name, because Christ is a term that means Messiah or anointed one. It is not proper for a Jew to refer to Jesus with that title, because he's not the Mashiach. But the name Jesus you can say. But some want to say that because he rebelled against the Torah, because at least his words, as they are reported to us, now we don't know if he said them, suggest that God abrogated his covenant with the Jews. So people say, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro, that he led people astray. Remember that the early Christians were Jews, right? It was only Paul. Paul was the one who started proselytizing the Gentiles. The early Christians were Jews who broke away. And therefore, in that sense, this was a movement taking away Jews, similar to Jews for Jesus today. So that's enough of a reason to add Yimach Shemo V'Zichro. You know, that's all. But you know, some people do it, some people don't. But that would be the reason.
You see the same Yeshua from the Gemara?
There are questions. There are passages in the Gemara that seem to talk about Jesus of Nazareth. But those passages had been censored in the Middle Ages. They were taken out. The newer Gemaras put them back in. But historians tell us we're not entirely sure, because there seems to have been a lot of messianic figures during that period of time. So it's hard to put it. Because the problem is, the Talmud indicates that a fellow called Yeshua was a disciple of the Tana Rav Yoshua ben Hananya. And the problem is, Rav Yoshua ben Hananya was like 100 years earlier than Jesus of Nazareth. So there are some historical problems that the fellow that the Gemara seems to be talking about seems to be earlier. So we don't have complete answers on that. Yeah.
Is the state of Israel at all bound to be part of the UN? And now, and since they are, do they have to follow treaties that are usually just anti-Semitic or anti-Israel?
Well, you know, the UN is really a brothel of Atala. I remember years ago, Ted Turner gave, I don't know what he gave, $2 billion to the UN. I said, so what a colossal waste of money. I shouldn't give somebody, you know, that amount of money and you use it for that. I mean, whoa. I mean, you might as well, you know, put it in the bathroom and the like. So Israel certainly doesn't have to belong to the UN, but you know, in spite of the fact that the UN as a whole is violently racist, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, and the like, there probably are some marginal advantages in being a member of the UN. First of all, the UN has other divisions. See, it's the Security Council and General Assembly that are the bad people at the UN. The UN does have a number of social service, like the World Health Organization, UNESCO. We used to collect when I was a kid on Halloween. We used to keep Halloween. You know, Jews used to keep Halloween, but you shouldn't. But so we used to collect for UNICEF. That's United Nations International Children's Fund, or something. So the UN does some good things on the periphery, right? But not the main bodies. Now, what were your second? Do they have to?
They have to follow treaties or laws that the UN enacts.
Well, no other member of the UN follows the treaties. You know, I mean, does Iraq follow? Does Syria follow UN? You know, on treaties? No. Ultimately, you have to understand that even legally, the United Nations is not a binding governmental body. Every country does have to make its own decisions. And no country, just like there's pikuach nefesh for individuals. If my life is in danger, I'm not bound by the Torah. If my national survival is in danger, I'm certainly not bound by some human law that says you can't defend yourself. So, you know, Israel is a very reasonable country, actually. It really is, although the world doesn't see it this way. And Israel is extremely protective of not only the Jewish citizens, but it's even protective of an Arab terrorist. In fact, I want to tell you a crazy proposal. There is now a proposal that will probably become the law in Israel, that if terrorists, you know, bomb a group and everybody goes to the hospital, if the terrorist is more seriously injured than the victims, the terrorist must be treated first. Now that's against halacha for sure, but it just shows you how Israel bends over backwards, even in crazy ways, to be protective. So if Israel needs to take sometimes actions which are a bit aggressive, they are doing so not out of expansionism, they are doing so in pure self-defense. So it really has nothing to apologize for, and it's a matter of pikuach nefesh.
And yep. Halachically, there's no aspect of Dina de Malchusa.
No, absolutely not. First of all, the UN is not a sovereign government. Even if there would be Dina de Malchusa, if my life is in danger, if I don't have to keep God's law if my life is in danger, I don't have to keep a human law if my life is in danger. Yeah.
So just like a couple questions have come up from different sugyas. Like in Arvei Pesachim, it speaks about the trachea and the
esophagus.
The esophagus being like next to each other. I'm not sure if that's actually accurate. And also it speaks about, like Rashi says that about the Yaakov and Esav, that then they so when you put in two marbles into a tube and then they come out in that direction. Like all these biological things that seem to be not necessarily accurate as far as current biology.
Yeah. Well, the trachea esophagus, actually, that happens to be fairly accurate. But
it is.
Yeah, it is. But you're making a larger point. That is, there are descriptions in both halachic matters and in Midrashim and Agadot.
Yeah.
Descriptions of reality that don't seem to correspond with what science seems to teach us. And the question is, do we say, well, Torah is right, science is wrong, and no matter what science say, I don't care? Or do we say science is right, and the sages might be making mistakes, which create certain problems? Or do I say they both can be reconciled in different ways? So here again, this is a big, 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 big question. I mean, one classic example I'll tell you is that according to the Gemara, you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos. because they don't reproduce sexually. The prohibition against taking life is only life that produces from male and female reproduction, and lice, Chazal say, produce through spontaneous generation of decaying matter. This is what it says. Now, problem is that although that was a common belief in the ancient world, so Chazal were not saying something crazy at the time, but scientific opinion is unanimous that there is no such thing as spontaneous generation, and even lice have, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Louse, and they reproduce, although it's very, very hard to see them. Now, that's an interesting example, because there, the so-called mistake, in quotation marks, is actually allowing you to do something. That would be Usher D'Oraisa. It's not just
being... is it now that we have the information, is it now Usher D'Oraisa?
Right, that's going to be the question, right. So here, the Poskim have basically said, in the case of the louse, that it's mutter even today. And the Chazanish says the following. Now, this will not answer every question you raised, but it answers some questions. The Chazanish says that halachic rules are not based on absolute reality. They are based on perceived reality. Meaning, Chazal knew that lice produce sexually, but it's not visible to the naked eye. And therefore, if to the naked eye it looks like spontaneous generation, then that is how halacha treats it, even if objectively that's not the case, and even if we later know through microscopes. An example would be insects. You know, we're very, very strict. You're not allowed to eat insects. And that's why people go crazy, rightfully so, in checking lettuce and strawberries, especially in Israel, which has a higher percentage of infestation. Because if you eat even a single ant, you transgress 5 prohibitions of the Torah. Very, very severe. On the other hand, here's the problem. I don't want to take away your appetite. But, you know, there's all sorts of microbes and germs and insects, that even the little insects, like that you're ingesting every breath. That's why that, what is that religion? How do you pronounce it? Janus, they pronounce it?
J-A-I.
Right, they wear these mesh things over their mouth because they don't want to inhale. You know. But we basically say, what you don't see doesn't count. What you don't see doesn't count. The Torah does not prohibit sub-visual phenomena. So in some cases, the way you have to understand it is, there's perceived reality and there's real reality. And halacha is based on perception, because the Torah was not given to angels in heaven. So that would be an approach for some matters. Now, we do have another approach, which goes all the way back to Rav Hai Gon and Rav Avram ben Aram, the Rambam and Rav Avram ben Arambam, that say, if it's not a halachic matter, see, lice is a halachic matter, then when Chazal are giving opinions on science, they are very wise, but they are not speaking as the receivers of a tradition that goes back to Hashem. They are speaking as very wise people, but as a result, it doesn't have to be more authoritative than the science of the time. Those Chazal are putting on multiple hats. There are times they're wearing the hats of being Balei Masorah. They are giving you the tradition of divinity, and in which case they have to be right. And then there are times they are speaking as educated scientists, in which case they are like educated, like Aristotle. Aristotle was a great intellectual person, but a lot of what he said was wrong. So that's another aspect of it as well, that in scientific matters, Chazal don't necessarily have that infallibility. That's another approach. A third approach, which I can't even give you that many examples right now, is that all of these things have to be understood in a spiritual, symbolic way, and they're not meant to be taken literally. This is an approach of the Maral. The Maral says that Chazal employed the science of the time, or the superstitions even of the time, to convey spiritual truths in a language that would be appreciated by the average listener. But they did not mean that the particular thing is a literal truth. It embodies a spiritual truth. This is the overall approach of the Maral to all of these types of agadas. Okay, anything else? Yeah.
Say again, the what? That
the sun
orbits the earth.
Yes.
The Judaism. And then somebody's told me that the Zohar says the opposite, as modern day science believes. I mean, how do we
Yeah, well, once again, I think what I just said is actually the answer to that, and that is Chazal understood that the earth revolves around the sun. But when Chazal talk about, just like, I mean, even in modern English we say this, we talk about sunrise, sunset. What do you mean? Are we pre-Copernicus? What do you mean sunrise, sunset? The sun doesn't rise and the sun doesn't set. The earth just turns. The answer is, yeah, the earth turns, objectively. But what I see is when I look at the sky. So the Torah speaks in the language of perception, even if the physical reality is something different. So it's no contradiction. I mean, if the sages talk about the sun rising and setting, they are discussing what it looks like to the observer. Even a statement, of course, this gets you into a lot of problems. Let's take the story in the book of Joshua. Do you remember the story? In the middle of a war against the Canaanites, God gave them a long day. The sun did not set. Four different opinions in the Gemara, 12 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours even. It didn't set. Now, you have a problem scientifically. If the science was the sun rises, the sun sets, so God just kept the sun there. But if the sun rising and setting is a function of the rotation of the earth, right, the earth rotates. So the only way you could stop the sun from setting is by stopping the earth's rotation. Well, let me ask you, if there are any scientists, what would happen if the earth would stop rotating? Well, we might fall off. It's not clear what happened. The gravitational field would be affected and the like. So how we understand certain miracles are indeed very, very difficult. How would a scientist... I mean, it was a miracle, no question. I'm just asking, what did the miracle involve? It didn't involve freezing the sun. It must have involved freezing the earth. In other words, stopping the earth. And the question is... And of course, all of the effects that would arise from that phenomenon were suspended as well. So there are problems. But all I'm saying is, the same way that in English we say sunrise and sunset, that's how the Torah talks. And it's not any more of a question than it is the way we talk. This is, what do Chazal say? Dibra Torah kelashon b'nei Adam. The Torah speaks in the manner of human speech. That is a statement in the Gemara. Okay, anyway, you'll be well. Have a good day. All right.